Welcome to the Iron Mind Podcast. Join me, Josh Brumley, as we explore the minds of those who forged their paths through legal battles, business triumphs, and creative conquests. In each episode, we sit down with inspiring individuals who've sharpened their resolve in the fires of entrepreneurship and law. From lawyers breaking barriers to entrepreneurs overcoming obstacles, we uncover the stories behind their iron wills and innovative minds. Get ready for thought-provoking conversations, practical insights, and actionable advice. This is the Iron Mind Podcast. Today, we will do a deep dive into cybersecurity, data protection, and tech strategy with tech powerhouse Amber Benwee. With a background that spans product management, cybersecurity, and DevOps across diverse industries like healthcare and education, Amber brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to the table. As a security product strategist at Datadog, Amber exemplifies a journey defined by her dedication to innovation and inclusivity. She's not only co-founded ventures such as University of Reddit and Hard Times Media, but also serves as a prominent advocate for diversity within the tech sector. Welcome to the podcast, Amber.
Thank you, Josh.
I don't know how many people who are listening to this podcast know this, but Amber was actually in the car with me the last time I significantly listened to the band that the podcast is named after. So Amber, thank you for your pivotal role in naming the Iron Mind podcast. I appreciate you very much.
I didn't even realize that was the last time. That's awesome.
Amber, so let's talk about confidentiality. Let's talk about how it relates to technology and how it relates to personal injury attorneys or law firms generally. What are some key measures that law firms should be taking to protect precious data, especially when it comes to cyber threats like social engineering?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as lawyers and as you may know, Josh, you're usually handling very confidential data, things like healthcare information, payment processing, banking information, especially as you're getting, you know, your case is paid out or you're accepting payments, social security information. A lot of this is governed under some pretty strict regulations, both in the United States, but also if you're working with international data, measures like GDPR, you know, other measures that are maybe less state or federal level, but just best practices overall. And so there's a number of things you can do to really minimize the risk of data going into the wrong hands. And so a lot of that starts with very simply, you know, making sure that any confidential data you're using or you're working with is stored in platforms that can follow those frameworks without you having to enforce those countermeasures. So I'd say, for example, if you're accepting things like confidential documents, data, making sure that you're not just emailing it or texting it, you know, finding a platform or a service that can handle, you know, the data storage and making sure that the security measures are applied on it. So a really good one that I like to recommend to customers is Box, for example. Box follows a lot. And by the way, that's not an endorsement, but I would say it's a very good service. It's great because there's a lot of measures you can put in place to ensure that only specific folders, specific things are only shared with the least, access permitted. So only people that need to know versus putting something in like Google Drive where you don't have as many measures that you could put in place against that type of information. And then, you know, another thing that I always tell my customers is don't hoard. Don't keep data that you don't need around because that also increases your risk profile. And, you know, in the case of, legal matters, I think, I don't know, Josh, how long do you have to keep your data around? I
guess. We have best practices and then a requirement as well. But most attorneys keep things for like 7 years.
Exactly. So
it's always a long time.
long time. And that's why it's really important to make sure that as you're storing things, you also follow least privilege access models so that, yes, you might have to store things for 7 years, but after you're done with that case, reducing who has access to that, because in a lot of cases, accounts that have more access to things than usual, those become the high profile targets at a company to, you know, get initial access.
Okay, so limiting access through platforms like Box, does OneDrive do that kind of stuff as well, or is that a recommended service?
Yeah, I would say any service that gives you the ability to change easily, like at, both at scale as well as like on an individual file basis or folder basis, is good. So your Box, your Dropbox of the world, you know, Google Drive's not bad. I think the main problem is like if your email gets compromised, so does everything that's stored in those types of services.
So what about if someone's not using any service for their client management? You know, they're not using a program like CasePeer or Practice Panther or Clio or all these other customer client service programs for entering in data and things like that. What if they're using like an Excel spreadsheet or something a little bit more simplified to keep their costs down? Are those faux pas? Is that still protected? How do you view that kind of maybe a social security number in a list on an Excel spreadsheet?
I mean, I think there isn't a wrong way to store data at scale. I think it's just knowing what your risk appetite is and what different vectors exist for having the data be compromised. I would say it's not on the top of my list. It's not my favorite thing. Hearing that information like social security numbers are safe, because all it takes is accidentally attaching the wrong file to an email and all of a sudden that's out in the wilderness, right?
Yeah.
I think another thing that's worth calling out is ransomware attacks are on the rise. They typically target things like personal devices, computers, things like that, that you know, part of the mechanism of ransomware is taking important information like files that are on that device and, you know, threatening to leak it, exploiting whoever got attacked, you know, with that information. So it's not my favorite. I mean, there's things you can do to individual files to protect them. Like you could, in Excel, for example, or I think even in Word, or any, word processing software or sheets, you can add a password, you can password protect specific things. So you can add those countermeasures so that even if the file is taken, it requires a secondary password or unique password for you to be able to access it. There's things that you could do to even password protect specific sheets within a spreadsheet. So there's things you can do there. However, I do recommend looking at those services that you recommended as the higher priority option, because usually with services like that, especially law firm focused software, those tend to also follow the best practices for security as well by proxy of being that type of a service or an offering.
That makes sense. So rather than digging into what all the rules are, using a platform that must have already dug into those rules before putting themselves out into the world. Okay. And you mentioned ransomware. Can you define that a little bit more? That's interesting. I'm not super familiar.
Yeah, ransomware can mean a lot of things. I mean, typically, if I simplify what the attack vector is, it's somebody like me. You know, I'm not like me, by the way. But basically,
like an evil version of you. Yeah, like a black hat version.
Exactly. I'm more white hat.
You're Amber, and this is like the Wario version of Amber, Whamber.
Exactly. Whamber, what you would do. So, for example, let's say I figure out your phone password or your email password, and I basically am able to get into your accounts or get into your devices and take them over so that you can't get access to them. And usually I hold those for ransom. And I say, Josh, I'm not giving you back access to any of your accounts until you pay me $1 million. And also, you know, in a lot of cases, You get blackmailed. So if they find sensitive information or things that could be compromising to you personally or your career, like that's usually part of the threat. And I've seen in a lot of cases, organizations being hit by ransomware attacks and actually paying out the ransom, which is illegal, believe it or not. And so there's a lot of service.
Illegal to pay the ransom?
Yes, but in a lot of cases it is, because usually what these organizations do is they pay it out so that they don't need to disclose to third parties or to the government that they were
That there was
breached.
a leak.
Yeah, it's really bad for reputation. I think in a lot of cases, especially in the case of a law firm, that's the last thing you want, to have a situation where you're held for ransom and then you have to go disclose to all of your clients that their most sensitive information may have been breached or accessed in some way.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
What about cyber insurance? Do you think that that's an important thing? Is there feedback for picking a policy that makes sense?
Well, there are tons of cyber insurance vendors on the market. I always say take preventative measures first. You buy the right security tools, employ the right people to make sure that you never have to use it, right? Cyber insurance can be really expensive. There can also be different types of policies that don't protect for every situation. In some cases, cyber insurance vendors may work with an organization that got breached and find that one line item. And you lawyers know your contracts, right? That
Yeah.
can cause, lead to a breach of contract not being paid out. And so, not only were you paying for the insurance and that didn't yield you anything, but now you also have to pay out of your own pocket to get through the remediation and disclosure process. And so that can be really expensive. And it's not just, telling your customers that you got breached. In some cases, it could be hiring a PR firm. It could be fighting a legal battle of your own, because someone's data or a group of folks' data got affected and they decided to sue you. So there is a lot more than just cyber insurance, although I do say that if you are taking the right preventative measures, it couldn't hurt to add that as like an additional, layer of protection.
What are those key preventative measures that you recommend before getting to the point of paying for the insurance as like the cherry on top?
Yeah, so every organization has different layers of security that they can put in place. I think part of it starts at the very beginning, like on a per person level. So, making sure that everyone that works in your organization has good password hygiene, has gone through training to not be social engineered, has gone through training to, sorry, go ahead, Josh.
I'm just sorry. These are technical terms that I don't even know what they mean. Can you talk about password hygiene? I could understand what that means from context, but
Yeah.
let's go into all of these because this is exactly what we need to hear for my staff, and I'm sure for anyone listening to this.
Yeah, for sure. So, like part of it, Josh, is like make sure your password's not password 123, right? You want to make sure everyone's using really unique passwords across different systems. Like your password for your work email shouldn't be the same as your personal Instagram and vice versa. Like that's a very common attack vector. Like one example is like I would never set my password for anything to be my dog's name, as much as I love him.
But I could set my password to be your dog's name.
Exactly, but don't do that now because
Oh,
anyone watching this
damn
is
it. I
taking
gotta
notes.
change all my passwords.
I now have to change Gilbert from everything. I'm just kidding, but edit that out, please. But yeah, so it's about using unique passwords. It's about making sure that everyone at your organization is using password managers, that they're not writing their passwords down in a notebook or in Post-it notes and sticking them on their devices.
Do you have a recommendation for a good low-cost password manager for firms that are like dealing with a budget issue of having password managers?
A lot of them have free tiers. I personally love 1Password. They're amazing. They're actually one of like Datadog's partners, which is great. So I would recommend them. But you can even find a ton of free password managers out there. Just any reputable password manager will usually come up and the Google search, right? But you know, and all of them have also free tiers. So I
Okay.
definitely recommend looking into something like that. Another thing to make sure of is ensuring that you have two-factor authentication on your account. So I don't know what your firm uses for your email or for your accounts, but in a lot of cases, a lot of the services will offer a two-factor authentication option, which means that like anytime you log into your account, you'll get a code sent to your phone. I think you've probably seen this in your bank accounts, for example, where it's like, hey, let's just confirm that this is actually you signing in. And so that actually reduces the risk of like, hey, should your passwords get compromised, there's at least a second layer of protection that prevents someone from just being able to log in because they have that information. So those are good measures. And then like on an individual basis, there's other things you can do. So, you know, a lot of organizations I work with hire and get services that can help carry out simulated phishing attacks. So phishing means like, you know, you send an email out to folks within your organization and see who clicks on a suspicious link. And so that can be very good for training because in a lot of cases, ransomware vectors, you know, different types of attacks, just look for people that are super gullible, right? Like, think about this, Josh. I could easily put together an email and send it out to your organization and go, hey, do you want a free $50 Starbucks gift card? Click this link. If it looks legitimate enough, people will click it. And it happens a lot more than you think. And that could be the pathway for someone to get ransomware software on your firm's devices, right? And all of a sudden now one computer in your organization's infected and that can get really out of control really quickly. So I would say it's always good to think about technology measures, but also training measures. So looking into ways that you could train people in your organization for not falling for common scams, not falling for that text message where you know, someone's impersonating you and telling someone to go in and buy $500 of gift cards for a client, right? So that's really good, and a lot of those fall into the category or the definition of phishing and social engineering and spoofing as well.
Do you have a recommended partner to do like a phishing simulation or some sort of phishing training or something like that?
There are a ton of really good ones out there. Let's see. I have a good one. Let me see if I can.
Mimecast shows up as a phishing simulation test. I don't know if you're familiar
Yeah,
with
I
them.
really like know before. It's KNOWBE4. And then the cool thing too is the government offers a lot of really good resources for it as well.
Oh, wow.
CISA, CISA, they have a ton of great content for free out there that you can use to train your team and just kind of spread the word and build awareness around that.
That's CISA.gov. Okay, great. These are all really, really helpful. I didn't expect to have so many things that I need to look into after this. Oh, shit.
Sorry to add more work on your plate.
Yeah, but it's good. I'd rather have these issues figured out before they're a significant problem, right? Like, I don't want to get a call from one of my clients that says, "Hey, somebody had my social because your receptionist gave it over the phone to someone who was impostering me," or a lot of different things. That's a nightmare to think about. So we try really hard to make sure we're training our staff to protect that information, to verify who people say they are on the phone, and my email address gets unverified clones of it. People getting emails that say, "Hey, this is Josh. I need you to go to the store and buy an eBay gift card. Don't call me about this. It's a secret," and stuff like that. And unfortunately, sometimes people will go to the store and call me from the checkout line and say, "Hey, you still need that eBay gift card? I just got to the checkout." And I'm like, "What are you talking about? No, when would anyone need an eBay gift card? It's 2024. Do people still log into eBay? I'm not familiar, but I can't think of a reason why I would need an eBay gift card at a personal injury law firm personally. But people don't ask those questions, and so training before it's an issue is super important. And the idea of doing like a phishing security test of the staff is like so fun, a fun way to do that training, to see who failed it and then roast them in a group setting in a safe way. Hopefully no one though.
Yeah, hopefully no one. I feel like the people at your law firm are very smart, so you should be good, but everyone else should take note.
Yeah, everyone else listening to this, if your staff isn't able to understand what phishing is, then do a phishing test. What are some of the I guess, for lack of a better word, no-nos for holding data? What are some things that you see that make you lose sleep as a data person that maybe a business owner might think, oh, this is no biggie, but you're very aware that is a common occurrence? Besides like writing down passwords, everyone knows, like, if I'm looking for someone's password, look under their keyboard, there might be a sticky note right there, stuff like that, you know, like that's embarrassing. And hopefully none of my staff have a password under their sticky notes, under their keyboard. But what are some things like that as a professional, you're like, this seems like common knowledge, but unfortunately, maybe it's not.
Well, probably a lot of people are not going to like this, but I would say sending very sensitive information just in like raw text over email drives me insane. Okay. It happens a lot more than you think.
Like if I emailed my social security number or something like that?
Yeah, that's like one of the most common things people do when they compromise email accounts or any account that has sensitive information is they're looking for those faux pas, right? So trying to abstract that and putting that type of information into a third party protected platform and emailing the link and restricting the access that way can help. I think also, like I said, making sure that you're continuously deleting information that doesn't need to exist anymore, because again, that reduces the amount of information that there is in there to take, right? So that's a big one. I would say like some other faux pas that I see is like in terms of like sharing data, sharing information before confirming someone's identity.
Right. Yeah. Big problem.
Big problem. And so there's a lot of times that I've seen, you know, people just out of convenience, just sending information over, whether it's someone maybe from another law firm calling you or asking for something and like looking through channels where they find the weakest link and they can get privileged information without following the right process or getting that information for their own benefit. So there's a lot of things you can do there. I think, you know, in a lot of cases, like if you're getting a request for something either over the phone or, you know, over email, like really double checking to make sure that that's going to the right person and making sure that you're educating your staff on the types of information they can send, especially privileged confidential information, how to confirm that. In a lot of cases, like I've seen organizations make runbooks for things. So like if there's common types of information that's requested, like putting together like a set of instructions or something that's referenceable so that your team knows like how to confirm someone's identity, as well as like what types of information they can share without getting special permission for it. And then I think the same goes also for types of data they can access without asking permission too. Again, it depends on how you're managing your data at your company, but there's some stuff that, you know, maybe only a key group of people at your firm or at a firm should have access to, and everything else is through escalation. So, you know, picking that type of information that you want to put out under lock and key and making a process around that is very important.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So just kind of tiering access to those who need it so that you minimize the risk of it being disclosed without authority or without permission.
Yeah.
Easy. Okay. What about, are there any emerging technologies or trends in cybersecurity that lawyers should be aware of to enhance their data protection efforts?
Yeah, so everyone's gonna groan when I say this, but deepfake technology is on the rise.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And I was meeting with a customer a couple of weeks ago who was telling me that they're seeing a rise in attacks just because of how accessible AI technology is. So we're talking like a script kiddie, like someone who's like very junior, being able to go into an AI tool saying, "Hey, this is the profile of what I'm trying to attack. Can you come up with a good way for me to get into this?" So they're dealing with a lot of organizations are dealing with very high volumes of attacks, very relatively minimal impact of attacks, but very high volume. So that's a big one. Another thing I want to call out is like deep fake technology is on the rise. So it's getting really easy for someone to impersonate your voice, impersonate your video, your impersonate video, make fake video, and have it say whatever you want it to say, right? And you know, a lot of that is coming from the fact that, you know, unfortunately, by us recording this podcast, it gives the ammo to someone to be able to scrape how we talk, scrape our video, and generate video. So that's worth calling out too.
So do you recommend like one of those voice changer tools and I'll put you like behind a shadow so that it's just your silhouette and you have like a voice changer so that you can't be deep faked? Like, how do we protect against being deep faked besides that silly situation? I don't know what to do.
I think it's pretty hard now. I mean, it would be nice of you to do it, but I've done so many videos at this point, it's too late for me. All hope is lost. I think we just want to wait, and I'm sure that there's going to be technology out there that's like a little bit more readily accessible that can call that out, you know?
That can sense whether something's been created as a fake or if it's a live recording of the real Amber.
Exactly, and vice versa.
Okay, but you're not familiar with any technology that exists as of today that can tell the difference?
I'd have to Google it, but yeah,
Okay.
I would look into that. If you feel like a lot of your business takes place over the phone, that might be worth looking into.
Can phone conversations be like hacked?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I had no idea. I thought phone conversations were the safest way.
Well, I can very easily find someone's voice and spoof it and call you using their voice. I mean,
I see.
so many
So
different ways
you're
to.
saying to mimic someone, you could do a phone conversation, but maybe like having access to someone's live phone call, that's not something that you'd have access to. Oh, okay. Okay.
That's
Okay.
pretty hard, knock on wood. Yeah.
Okay. At least for now. Who knows what's going to happen in 10 years?
Yeah, who knows?
What about remote work? What are some key remote work safeguards that people who are working from home or from like a public access network, like a Starbucks or something like that, what should people be aware of when they're on different Wi-Fi and things like that? Airports, on the airplane.
Always use a VPN.
Okay. Can you define a VPN for the non-tech savvy older lawyers that are listening to this?
Yeah, so it's like virtual private network. It basically shields your computer from being able to send, you know, sensitive information like unfiltered into, you know, anything that might be looking for it. I think that's a good way of describing it in a non-technical way. And there's a couple good ones out there. I'm pretty sure that, you know, Microsoft offers one. There's one called AppGate,
The one
Sophos.
that Microsoft offers, I think, is ExpressVPN. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, they're all pretty good. I mean, I don't think there's a bad VPN on the market, right? They all
Okay.
have the same job. They might have different types of frills, but yeah, I would say always use a VPN, even if you're at home. It's just good practice to use that. And then, you know, avoid public Wi-Fi. Like if you're in a situation where you're not using a known network, like try to hotspot if you can. That's a really good measure. And, you know, like other things that I think are very common, I would say get a privacy screen. I can't tell you how many times I've been on a plane and I'm sitting next to someone
You
who's
can
like,
read everything that
I'm nosy. I will look. I've seen competitors with no privacy screens on. I've seen people working on healthcare stuff with, it's just like crazy. It's like, if it's there, I will look, right? You're
Wow,
broadcasting. So yeah, you never know. You never know who you're sitting next to. That's what I always tell people. So I would do, you know, say that. And then yeah, there's like other common things like I, you know, don't have sensitive conversations in public, right? Again, just like people can see, they can also hear you. So those are the best practices, I think, and for the most part. I would say remote work is fine, as long as you're being smart about where you're using your devices, what conversations you're having outside of your home. Yeah, pretty straightforward.
I'm super interested in like the value of a data breach lawsuit, and the first one that comes up here is a Morgan Stanley data breach class action lawsuit that settled for $60 million. Another data breach lawsuit against RadNet Data, $2.6 million. Like these are not small value claims, and I don't know the facts of these cases, but I'd assume that the most significant data that can be breached is people's bank information and people's social security numbers and people's healthcare information, and that seems to be all stuff that lawyers deal with. So it makes sense from a person who's trying to get access to that type of data to target small law firms who maybe don't have that infrastructure and would be easy marks to get this information from, with a receptionist maybe who doesn't understand what the rules are, or an email phishing scam or something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. The like you said, breaches are expensive. The average cost is a pretty big financial burden. Doesn't matter how big or small of an organization you are, it's a non-trivial cost. You know, on the public sector side, we've seen breaches increase in price. For the public sector, it's about $2 million for the cost of the breach. That could involve paying ransomware, hiring a firm, a third-party firm, to come in and do an audit as to what happened, paying legal fees. Like, there's a lot that goes into a breach. That's why we say, go get that insurance. Go buy what, like, you shouldn't put a strict budget on security tooling because it always pays dividends, right? Like, a lot of customers I see, like, they end up killing their security tools because they say they don't see the value out of it, where the value is it prevented a, you know, breach from happening, right? And then
A
buying all
$60 million
the,
settlement. Like, that seems pretty significant.
yeah, it's pretty easy to scoff at how expensive security tools are when you don't realize how expensive a breach costs, right? In comparison.
Okay, well, that's important. So then, I guess in closing, what happens after a breach? Like, how can we, if unfortunately a breach has occurred, what are the best ways to fix or minimize damage? What should we do first? What's the process like from your standpoint, from a law firm?
There's a number of different things. It also happens, it depends on the type of breach that you've had. For example, like if it's a small thing, like somebody's password got compromised, you know, it starts off with making sure that you close off that account, you plug the leak, right? In the case of like bigger breaches, right? Like usually there's like supervisory organizations that you'd want to work with. In fact, like the FTC has a really good guide for businesses that you can follow. I think it's just you look up data breach response and it applies to any type of organization. In fact, I'm looking at it right now and they have free copies that they'll send you if you want the paper copy of it. But yeah, I think like the first thing is, you know, being able to identify exactly what happened, like figuring out what the scope of the breach is, because that helps you figure out what types of notifications you need to make, whether it's something small where it's making sure that that person's account or that specific account is just plugged and you take the right precautions to make sure it doesn't happen again or there isn't a repeat incident, or if it's something bigger where it's like understanding what parts of your system were affected, what type of data was lost. And in a lot of cases, hiring a third party organization to come in and help run the forensics, figure out what legal implications might exist, because in a lot of cases, like unless you're a security focused law firm, you're going to need to get a firm that specializes in that, because they'll be able to tell you exactly what the disclosure process looks like, what's at risk, like what you can do to minimize impact, on the up end. And then, of course, in the future, there's always the retrospective, which is, putting measures in place to make sure things like that don't happen again, no matter how big or how small. I will say that I've seen some cases where a breach is so bad that the business just goes out of business. So it will never happen again because your business doesn't exist anymore. We call those company ending events.
Company ending events.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Look, very rarely have I seen that happen. And there's been some pretty big breaches out in the world. I can't name any of them, but I'm sure you guys have a couple that come to mind when I say that. They're still businesses. So, I mean, as long as you have the right measures in place, you'll never get there. But if you have the right capital, you'll have the countermeasures to avoid ending your business. You just don't want to be in that situation, right?
Right. Have the safety measures in place before you have a potential business ending event, because you don't want to be in that seat. And paying $20 a month for some of these subscription services seems like, what am I paying $20 a month for? But I mean, the difference between $20 a month for a password manager and 60 million for a settlement of your data breach seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think it's that. It's also knowing what regulations the data you have follows. So, like in the case of healthcare information, HIPAA governs that in the US. In the case of credit card or bank information, PCI. So it's familiarizing yourself with those types of regulations as well, because it can also inform you of what types of services you'd want to put in place or vendors you'd want to start to work with to do that from the beginning, right? As opposed to waiting for the end.
Well, Amber, thank you for all these insights. Do you have any information in closing that we didn't cover that you think might be important for law firms? Or do you have, in closing, just some remarks about how people can get in contact with you or your business to get some advice?
Yeah, so I would say there's a ton of free resources out there. Leverage what you see on CISA and the FTC. I think a big focus for the United States is getting better with our security practices and standardizing on that. I happen to work for an amazing company called Datadog. We have security solutions. Definitely recommend checking that out. But really, it's about starting small. I think it's better to do something than try to do everything all at once. So it's as easy as just making sure that what you're doing on a day-to-day, you're following the best practices and then working up from there and coming up with like a good practice for your entire organization.
So a password manager to start off, so we're not using sticky notes, is the first place to start.
Yeah, clearly you're listening, Josh. I love that. Password manager. Two-factor authentication. Do not use your dog's name as a password because that's not a good thing to try.
Everybody on the internet knows my dog's name. Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, my thing is always say start small. Don't try and do everything at once. Like, good security is cultural. It's not really something that you could solve with like having the most expensive tools and the most complicated processes. And once you get the culture down, good security culture, I think everything else is really easy to do.
So make sure you're training and having these discussions on a regular basis
Exactly.
with a phishing test from nob4.com.
I'm not sponsored by them, but yes,
But
something
you
like
should be.
Exactly.
I'll send them an email after this asking you to get a job offer or something.
Oh my God.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Amber, for being a part of the show. I hope you're doing well out there in Boston. I hope your dog Copley is enjoying a nice bone or something tasty.
Oh, yeah.
And a blurry version, a censored out version of the dog. Beautiful.
Yeah, I don't want his picture to get out on the internet. So.
You don't want any deep fakes of Copley popping out and, you know, sending you a fake video that says, "Mom, I need money for bones, please. I'm in jail."
Yeah, be careful. That's the next attack vector.
Pets. Oh my God.
Oh man.